I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Anderton does well to get across into Sheringham. Sheringham scores. I thought he'd lost it with his first touch, but recovered fast to beat Kevin Pressman. Anderton, Sheringham, Anderton, and he's through. Anderton, lovely return from Sheringham. Spurs are two up. Darren Anderton. It's Chris Barr-Williams flying down that right-hand side. Behind the Spurs defence again. In for Bright, good touch. Oh, and whacked in by Calderwood, I think it is. Unless Barr-Williams got a slight deflection. Nice touch by Mark Bright, but Calderwood's attempted block turned out to be the equaliser.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Jonathan Wilson is opposite me, of course. And today on the pod, we have Jack Pitbrook, football writer for The Athletic and host of The Athletic's Tottenham Hotspur podcast. Jack, lovely to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Marcus.
Yeah, not at all. Now, today we're talking about Tottenham Hotspur going to Hillsborough on the opening day of the 1994-95 Premiership season. The game ended 4-3 to Ozzy Ardiles' Tottenham Hotspur. Why, Jack, have you gone for this game?
Well, it was a classic game in itself. It's memorable most famously for the Jurgen Klinsmann dive celebration.
Yes.
Which is still very much, I think, exists in the public mind a lot. You see it a lot on,
well, for a generation,
Premier League years. Yeah.
For a generation of fans, you call it, oh, he celebrated with a Klinsmann.
Yeah, it's like the most, I think it's probably the greatest celebration in the history of the Premier League. Or at least the most memorable single celebration.
Yeah, be up there.
I can't think of any rivals to that.
Yeah.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean,
what about Daniel Sturridge's little dance?
Yeah.
Crouch's robot?
No, I mean, Crouch's robot was more for England, wasn't it?
True, yeah.
Yeah, you're probably right. I sort of have quite mixed feelings about the celebration because I sort of hate that sort of slightly naff Germanic grin he gives it before doing the slide. The slide itself is a kind of, it's a brilliantly conceived PR moment,
yeah,
of owning the thing that everybody's been chucking at him.
Yeah, yeah. Completely.
But there's something about that California German business speak naffness.
Hang on, this was years before any Californian business.
He always had Californian in him.
I think that's to his credit. And I think we all, if any of us had it, you'd flaunt it, surely.
Not me.
I'm talking to a lad from Sunderland there.
So it's like a classic.
Sorry, Jack.
It's got this amazing. Like, one, it's a fantastic game. Yes. Like, it's back and forth, 4-3. Yeah, yeah. It also has that, like, it buzzes with that sense of excitement because it's the first game of the season, but also the first game of an era. Like, Ardiles was there the previous season, mm-hmm. but in the summer of 1994, he bought Klinsmann, Popescu, and Dumitrescu, mm. which was, like, unprecedented, yeah. really, to have three big stars from the 1994 World Cup all come to the Premier League.
Well, Klinsmann's a World Cup winner.
Yeah, for a combined, I think, like £8-9 million.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of perfect mix, isn't it? Because Romania had been sort of the most exciting of the outsiders. I mean, arguably Bulgaria as well, but they've been a really exciting outsider in that World Cup. Mm. And they've been a team who really impressed people with the sort of the technical quality of their play.
Beating Argentina.
Yeah, in one of the greatest games. I mean, hopefully we'll do that game at some point. That is a brilliant game. So to get two of the sort of the sort of trendy team plus this bona fide world star from Monaco at a time when the Premier League didn't get bona fide world stars,
and even Sheffield Wednesday had their own Romanian, Dan Petrescu, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And I was looking through the so I wrote an article about this, which you can read on The Athletic. And I was looking through the other big summer signings into the Premier League from abroad that year. And they were like good players. Like, I think Brian Roy was there. Stefan Schwartz was there. Philippe Albert came in. But this was generally still at the era where it was unusual for English teams to sign top foreign players, especially ones who were like not necessarily. I mean, there were more obviously from Scandinavia, Low Countries, the Republic of Ireland. But to get kind of big names from slightly further afield in Europe was still a really, really big deal.
And that's part of the changing sort of profile of the English game.
Yeah.
That, you know, the reason that Scandinavians, Ireland, Low Country have come in is partly because the capacity to speak English is obviously extremely high in those countries. And so, there's a natural sort of synergy with English culture. But also their football is quite similar, particularly Scandinavia or Ireland coming to Britain. It's a shared football culture. We understand that 4-4-2. You bring in Romanians, well, there's got to be adaptation on both sides. And I think this is the beginning of the Premiership, Premier League.
Yeah. Do you think it was the first? Go on, sorry.
So you're just becoming this sort of this global melting pot. It's at the very beginning of becoming this global melting pot where best practice is done here.
Yeah. Do you think it was the first season of that where the Premiership? It was called the Premiership back then, of course. Do you think it was the first season where it began to really look like?
Yeah, I do. What we know? I do, and I think these three signings are very sort of emblematic of that: the big star plus the exciting outsiders.
Because you can't forget what Tottenham were doing then with these signings.
Easy to forget how good a player Popescu was.
Oh, magnificent!
I mean, he ended up not playing in this game for Wednesday, but Popescu very nearly went to Barcelona.
Yeah, so Cruyff tried to get Popescu that summer to replace Koeman. And when I was doing the research for this article, I spoke to a lot of the guys who played in this team. So I spoke to Mabber, Anderton, Sheringham, Barmby. And what they all said, so some of them weren't that keen on. So Sheringham had a go at Dumitrescu, said that he didn't.
Was Sol Campbell not available for comment?
I actually couldn't get hold of him.
So yeah.
He didn't track back enough. And that, we can come on to that because that was one of the reasons why it didn't work.
Yeah.
But they all spoke so positively about Popescu. They said, what a player he was. He was fantastic. But certainly, I think Jonathan's absolutely right that. Like the Premiership in 1994-95, it couldn't really absorb players of this quality, really. Mm-hmm. It was so, like, the cultural incongruity of having very, very, very technical, very clever, maybe not so physical players in it didn't quite work.
Yeah, because I think of Chelsea being one of the teams, with Ruud Gullit and making those big signings, but one can forget Spurs. With those players coming in. This was the first season I ever did fantasy football.
Oh, wow.
I remember, and of course it wasn't online back then, so you'd sort of fill it in, and putting in these players like Ilie Dumitrescu. My goodness, really felt foreign, but in a very exciting way.
In a sense, Sheffield Wednesday team is more sort of telling of that. You look at that side, and there are two foreigners. So you've got John Sheridan, who's Irish, and you've got Petrescu.
Yeah.
And this is August 1994. By Boxing Day 1999, Chelsea are fielding a team of entirely foreign players.
Yeah.
It didn't take long for that to happen. And even the Tottenham side, there are one, two, in this particular game, because Popescu doesn't play, there are only Zony Klinsmann and Dumitrescu. The rest are all British.
Yeah. And Spurs, they did have a very young Sol Campbell at the back. as we've mentioned, and Teddy Sheringham up the top, and both of them would go on and achieve amazing things, quite frankly. But what was, I mean, they enjoyed playing under Ardiles, didn't they, in the short time? Sheringham spoke quite highly in the piece that you wrote.
The players loved playing for Ozzie because he was so attacking. Like he would encourage them to get on the ball, dominate possession, everybody go forward, both fullbacks, almost everyone in midfield except for the holder. So they'd really be defending only with the two centre-backs and the one holding midfielder.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so unusual, really, to have this this very expressive, very attacking, very risky style of play, which Ardiles said that he'd learnt playing for Menotti, for the Argentina national team, and he was keen
in 78.
And he was keen to recreate it in English football. And so for the players, it was like something from another world. It was so refreshing to them, and that's why they loved it so much, even though we know, we can say now that it was in fact so attacking that it left them open to the back, and that's why the results were bad and he was eventually sacked.
Well, I don't think that was known even at the time. This was his fourth club in English football.
Yeah.
So I'd seen him quite, he was Newcastle manager in 91-2 at a time when I would go to, I'd go to every Sunderland home game, I'd go to maybe half a dozen Newcastle home games a season. And I remember them, a hilarious game when they were really good, went 3-0 up against Charlton and ended up losing 4-3 to, I think I'm right in saying, a Kevin Lisby hat-trick followed by a sensational own goal from Liam O'Brien. And
Lisby had been playing back then.
Was it Lisby? One of those mediocre Charlton forwards got a hat-trick. But yeah, a last-minute diving-headed own goal.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as a Sunderland fan being there, I could not stop laughing.
It was never boring under Ardiles.
He took it up a level this season, but that sort of incredibly cavalier approach had always been characteristic of him.
Yeah, and so what was his, we can't ignore his relationship with Alan Sugar, who's obviously parting with the cash to bring in some of these players.
Yeah, so Sugar, like the big thing at Tottenham in the sort of early to mid-90s was Sugar's war with Venables.
Yes.
Sugar eventually won this, and Venables was replaced as manager in 1993 with Ardiles. Then Spurs were hit with this big punishment by the FA for illegal payments, which I think had actually preceded Alan Sugar. It was initially, I think, a huge fine, expulsion from the FA Cup, and 12-point deduction.
That's a serious punishment.
Yeah. And then they appealed against it, and it got reduced to 6 points.
Yeah, and we're back in the FA Cup.
Yeah, but it's still a kind of
but it was
six points is a lot.
It's unheard of nowadays, really, especially for a top flight side.
Yeah, I mean, you get the huge point deductions for going into the receivership, but it's
it would be kind of unimaginable for a big club to be hit with something like that now, because the big clubs are so powerful. But so this was obviously a huge blow to Spurs, and Sugar was smart enough to realise that he needed to kind of re-engage and re-energise the fans a bit. So he did this first with the appointment of Ardiles in 1993, and then Ardiles had his first season working with this kind of slightly more conventional Tottenham squad. And then in the summer of 1994, Sugar backed Ardiles with this big, glamorous spending spree. So it was really, like, the construction of this team, which is really, really interesting, it wasn't done as a kind of experiment in, like, the can we make the Premier League more cosmopolitan? It was a kind of PR exercise by Sugar to re-engage Tottenham fans with some kind of sexy people from abroad.
And I guess that's sort of was part of the history of a Tottenham.
Yes.
When Ardiles had arrived as a player, that had been the same logic. When he'd arrived after, and again, when he arrived in 78 with Ricky Veer, Ricardo Biche, to our Argentinian listeners, they'd gone to, in that case, the World Cup winners, but a glamorous team from the World Cup picked up two of their stars in just the same way they'd picked up three of the World Cup stars this summer.
So where did Tottenham sit in the mid-90s? Because they'd won the FA Cup in 91 against Clough's Forest. Arsenal had won a couple of trophies, and there's the comparison there. I mean, Arsenal were not in brilliant shakes. Wenger hadn't taken over just yet. But Spurs, because people may think of Spurs now, but for many years they were sort of a middling to fair
side. Well, that's what they were. They were a middling team with obvious pretensions and potential. They were definitely the second side in London. I guess they were better than Chelsea at the time. But Arsenal had just won the Cup Winners' Cup the previous season.
Well,
so there's no question that, although the sort of peak of George Graham's Arsenal was past, Arsenal were still the kings of London.
And in 93, well, they won what, League Cup and FA Cup?
Yeah, that's right.
Beating Sheffield Wednesday in both finals.
And they also had Spurs, even though they hadn't really played that way for a while, Spurs fans still had this expectation for entertainment, which is still, you know, which is still very much with us today. And that is why this was so exciting for them, because they thought that they had...
Yeah, I mean, they'd had the great team of the David Pleat team of the sort of mid-80s, 87, I guess, was their peak, which, you know, we talked about last month with John Cross.
They're
talking about the game when they lost to Arsenal in the Littlewood Cup semi-final replay. So there'd been a definite decline since then. And I think maybe the Venables thing... There'd been high hopes after 91 and the Venables might be able to inspire them, and then obviously his war with Sugar meant that that didn't come to fruition.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was obvious they were a team with potential, but they were also one of those teams who'd never achieved it.
Yeah, very true. Alright, let's have a quick break, and after which we'll talk about the match itself. See you in a moment, everybody.
Another nice touch by Sheringham. Away goes Barmby. He's got Klinsmann on his left. It's still Nick Barmby with the goal that puts Spurs back in the lead. 3-2.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Anderton, a good cross for Klinsmann. Jürgen Klinsmann, a great header, and the German star opens his account with a dive.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. Right then, so it was the first game of the season. It's an always an exciting time, but especially for those Spurs fans, with those new signings in there, a lot of fans went up to Sheffield to see this game, even just wanting to get a glimpse of what Jürgen Klinsmann would look like in a Tottenham shirt.
Yeah, there was so much... there's like a sort of myth going on, I don't know if it's a myth, but Spurs fans always talk about this, about how it was impossible to drive up to Sheffield because the motorways were clogged with Tottenham fans. And there was such a... it's kind of difficult looking back now to think of a comparison. Maybe Rubinho at City, but in terms of like the glamour and the sort of shock at seeing this kind of world superstar in the shirt.
I think Ruud Gullit at Chelsea might
be one. Maybe. Like, there were stories of even the pre-season friendlies, like there was a famous one at Vicarage Road, which I think might have been the first time that Klinsmann played for Tottenham in any capacity. And like the swarms of people there, it was like the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
Like, and so people were desperate, absolutely desperate to go and watch Jürgen Klinsmann play for Tottenham.
And you can't underestimate what a good player Klinsmann was.
Right.
Because, I mean, there's so many great forwards over the years, but Klinsmann was superb. You know, World Cup winner, as we say. But Jonathan, he had everything in his locker, didn't he?
Oh, brilliant footballer. And as a forward, I mean...
Do you think underrated as history's gone on?
He's got a winning mentality.
He could score goals, create goals, all types of goals.
Yeah, I mean, I think to an extent he suffers by comparison with Van Basten, who was a similar type of player in being complete, but Van Basten was better.
Right.
But Klinsmann was still a magnificent footballer.
Yeah.
And, you know, that Germany team of 1990, he's, you know, the best attacking player in that side. You know, he's, but yeah, he's score from outside the box. He could score headers. He's good on the ball.
Mm-hmm.
He's good at drawing fouls.
Very good, yeah, you could say. But that's why, you know, putting Tottenham in the context of where they were, for him to go there. Because, I mean, his Monaco side, I think, you know, remember them in the semi-final of the Champions League getting beaten by, would it have been Capello's Milan, you know. Mm. Yeah, that's the kind of level he was playing at, to then go to this sort of middling.
Well, I think the thing with that Monaco side, there was because they got done by the match-fixing, by Tapie's match-fixing, mm-hmm. where there was a lot of disillusionment around Monaco then. And you sort of see that team sort of breaks up pretty quickly in the early 90s. And I think it was just a sense of...
Mm-hmm. Sugar, sorry, chance.
That's why Wenger went to Japan.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
he was so disillusioned with French football that... And you understand why. You know, we can have a brilliant team, we can do everything to get to the top of the table, and they'll still stiff us.
Yeah, yeah. Very
why?
True.
Why would you stay behind? Yeah, I think it's an understandable.
Mm. True enough.
But it's also, I think. I mean, I'm older than both of you, and so I'm going to say this with my old man hat on.
Uh-huh.
This is the days before football is on TV live. On a really regular basis.
Yeah.
Is it, I mean, if you got Sky, it's a game a week.
Yeah, yeah.
So going to see somebody in the flesh was still what you did. That's how you saw a big player, was you got on the bus and you went.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of mentality doesn't really exist anymore. We're so used to everything being televised that, I mean, obviously live events are still a huge thing, but if you wanted to see Klinsmann, you pretty much had to go and see him.
Mm-hmm. And him playing up front with Teddy Sheringham was quite a nice duo.
Yeah.
Sheringham was very important to that team.
Yeah, and Sheringham and Klinsmann love playing with each other.
Yeah.
I spoke to Sheringham.
I mean, they're perfectly sort of complementary styles, aren't they?
I spoke to Sheringham for this story, and he was so, so positive about Klinsmann, about his intelligence and his work rate. And a lot of people talk about how he was with the young players, and he would kind of set an example. Because this is very much, you know, there's a lot of similarities between this particular story and the story of Wenger's arrival at Arsenal. And one of those similarities is the contrast between the kind of pre-existing English culture of, yeah, we'll train for a bit, then we'll go for 10 pints, and the kind of professionalism of the foreign players who've arrived who don't really train that way. And so at Tottenham, you know, they had a kind of conventional drinking culture of English players. And then Klinsmann showed up, and it was this kind of incredibly rigorous approach to training, you know, very inclusive of the younger players as well, but he would spend hours out on the pitch. I think the training at Mill Hill then, kind of working on his game, and, you know, big bag of balls, put every single one in the top corner, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
In a way that was, like, slightly unfamiliar then.
Well, another one of these players that people couldn't believe they saw him in their club shirt would have been Ravanelli at Middlesbrough.
Yeah.
And he said that when he joined Middlesbrough, I mean, John, you probably know more, that he had a sort of, you know, fax, back to Juventus to get them to send him sort of drills and whatnot so he could do in the afternoon, because he couldn't believe that all the local sort of English players and whatnot would train for a couple of hours or whatever in the morning. As you say, some go on the pierce or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that signing is, I think, even more extraordinary than this. I mean, Tottenham were at least a glamorous club in London. For them to get him and Janinho and Emerson was a very curious business. That fits into what we were saying about the rapid internationalisation of the Premier League, Premiership.
Which was so vile for the
development. When a team like Middlesbrough, with all due respect to what was a very good Middlesbrough team in those days, that they can get three players of that stature.
One have just won the Champions League as well.
Yeah, and Janinho, who'd been brilliant in when Brazil had last been to Wembley, you know, the culture changed very, very quickly.
Yeah, indeed. But Spurs had some decent English players as well. Darren Anderton, Nick Barmby, very young Sol Campbell, of course. Stalwart Gary Mabbott among them. So this game against Sheffield Wednesday, against Trevor Francis, Sheffield Wednesday, who weren't a bad side, they'd finished seventh the previous season and had some decent players in there. Ardiles lines up with that attacking formation, and one of the commentators immediately says, just before the game, Spurs playing with, you know, mentions the front five Tottenham are playing. And I remember this. People were just... like almost ridiculing Spurs or Ardiles, going, what five up front? As if it was like a throwback to the old formations from a bygone era of 2-3-5. But that's not quite how it was.
Yeah, so I've spoken to Steve Perryman about this, who was the assistant for Ardiles. And I think the way how they saw it was more of a sort of 4-4-2 diamond.
Yeah.
So he didn't actually have all the players in place for this game, but basically a 4-4-2 diamond in which they'd have Sheringham and Klinsmann as the front two, which, the you know, like you said, a fantastic front two. And then generally, I think Nicky Barmby as the number 10.
A decent player himself.
Yeah, with Anderton, it kind of became Anderton and Dumitrescu either side, and then initially Calderwood, and then eventually Popescu holding, but with both fullbacks going on. So it wasn't quite a two, it wasn't quite like a 2-3-5. Well, there was a joke going around the club, which is that they had, I think I can probably say this on here, the famous five and the shit six.
I love the thought of Popescu or Calderwood. That's your choice. Yeah. I wonder, you know, the man for the moment. But yeah, so, and it's a very young Sol Campbell at the back. And he started, who was partnering him in the centre?
Nethercott in this game.
Nethercott in that, yeah. So the game gets underway, and on 19 minutes, Teddy Sheringham, I suppose it's a mistake really at the back from Sheffield Wednesday, and he kind of controls the
ball. Sheffield Wednesday have been a bit of a funny team, because they've got three fullbacks in there as well.
Mm.
And I think it's, to be honest, the numbers are very hard to see on the Sheffield Wednesday shirts.
They are.
So if Peter Atherton is listening to this, and it wasn't his mistake, I apologise to him, but I think he gets caught. It's him who gets caught under the ball.
Uh-huh.
And Sheringham's got hours to take the ball down. It's a great first touch.
A lovely finish.
But it doesn't really need to be. His second touch is a bit rubbish, but it doesn't really matter.
Mm.
And then he sort of, it's a weird finish, because he's got loads of times, ends up just sort of stabbing it with the outside of his right foot into the bottom corner.
Effective, though.
Yeah, it's a very good goal. It's a great cross from Anderton, and the first and third touches are excellent. The second one, maybe not quite.
But the build-up to Spurs' second goal, which comes only about sort of 10, 11 minutes later, which Anderton finishes, is quite a nice slick move, if I remember correctly.
And that's like Sheringham, and this would have been the first time that Sheringham and Klinsmann played together.
Yeah.
And yet, even in their combination for that Anderton goal, which puts Spurs 2-0 up, you can see that they just have that, like, when two players who haven't really played together that much have that like instinctive understanding, because they're both clever players.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always, there's always that, when you're a fan, the first game of the season, you always want to see how your new heroes are going to kind of gel straight into the team. And so to see Klinsmann like instantly have that rapport with Sheringham up front was a sign that, wow, this could actually work out.
Mm. I have to confess that I didn't really, you know, as a teenage boy, I didn't really rate Sheringham until probably like Euro 96, which is to my detriment, really. He could, for me, you know.
Well, he changed as a player. I mean, when he was at Millwall, and then his one season plus one game at Forest.
Yeah,
he was much more of a goal scorer.
Yes,
I mean, I think he obviously always had that intelligence, but he got deeper as he got older, and you know, became more of a schemer than the finisher.
Mm-hmm. But if you think about the forwards that were the English forwards that were knocking around the Premiership then. Sort of Fowlers and Coles, Shearers, Ferdinands, you know.
Right.
Right as well. You know, there was so many. And Sheringham was a little bit different to them. And he wasn't so much as a goal machine. But when you look back at Sheringham, with his touches and the intelligence that he had, it was quite glorious. At halftime it was 2-0 to Tottenham Hotspur. So all's going very well in the camp, all's going to plan. And then into the second half, Dan Petrescu pulls one back for Sheffield Wednesday on 54 minutes.
You'd question the defending there.
You would question the defending.
Chris Bart-Williams corners half cleared to John Sheridan, who volleys it back in and sort of just... So, then suddenly Petrescu's clean three, which makes no sense.
And
but.
It, possibly the first question of a long line of questions of that Tottenham Hotspur defence under Ardiles.
Campbell only out to Sheridan. Oh, to Petrescu! Well taken goal. I'm not sure whether Sheridan's pass to him was a fluke or intentional. Dan Petrescu with a lot of room. It's 2-1.
So 6 minutes later, one of the great own goals.
Yes.
Colin Calderwood smashing it into his own net.
It's an absolute beauty.
Chris Bart-Williams has cut in from the right, and he's sort of in trying to challenge him. He ends up slamming it into the roof of his own net.
It's an absolute beauty. It's a very 90s own goal.
Yeah.
You don't get too many of them nowadays, I think. Which is sad to see, quite frankly. And then is it Nick Barmby who races through?
Yeah, so yeah, Sheringham plays through Barmby. Barmby, who probably one of the quicker, more energetic players in that Spurs team, charges through and just smashes it past Kevin Pressman for 3-2.
Mm.
It's a lovely pass from Sheringham as well. I mean, you're starting to see, I think the second goal particularly, but this one as well, you sort of see how those components of that, I mean, front five is a misleading term, but it's not a totally inaccurate term.
Right.
You can see how that sort of fits together and how that might work.
And they were very dependent on you know, the intelligence of Sheringham in slightly deeper positions, and then Dumitrescu and Barmby charge forward into the box.
Yeah. Well, who was it who said that the main tactical instruction they got was when Teddy gets it, just bomb forward?
I think Sheringham himself might have told me that, or maybe Mabbott. But right. Yeah, that was very much the approach. Sheringham pulls off, gets the ball, and then everyone, as in you got Klinsmann, Dumitrescu, Barmby, the fullbacks, and who might have been. Generally, what Austin and Edinburgh it was usually for this team. Mm-hmm. Basically, everybody gets forward, and then Sheringham will sort it out.
Glorious! All these goals going in, but Mr. Klinsmann hasn't got one himself yet. But that would be rectified on the 82nd minute when he scored his first goal in English football, or you know, in the main competition. And the ball comes in, and it's a lovely header.
Yeah, a great cross from Anderson, and a great header.
Yeah, I mean, it's the way he slightly hangs in the air and stoops his neck a bit. Neck muscles.
Yeah,
bang.
It's a properly sort of. He hasn't just run onto the cross. He's sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's used all his neck muscles to, you know, to get the power and get the direction on it.
Mm-hmm. And that's the moment, of course, where he wields away and does the famous Klinsmann dive celebration to have a little answer back to all his critics who. Who, let's be honest, were pretty xenophobic towards him when he came to the country.
Definitely. I mean, it's sort of really interesting, kind of looking back at this, quite how disgraceful a lot of the anti-German.
Oh yeah.
Coverage.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you can forget in Euro 96 when England drew Germany in the semi-final. I can remember that vividly.
Yeah, the Mirror's front page, Achtung surrender.
All that bollocks. And then, but Klinsmann himself is getting, this is, international tournament is, I mean, obviously that's a disgrace anyway, but an international tournament is one thing.
It's a bit more, I mean, obviously, yeah, it's a disgrace, but I understand where it's come from.
Yeah.
Whereas the sort of just baseline xenophobia here, I found quite disturbing.
If you think that xenophobia and sanctimony about diving are bad now, they were really, really bad in 1994. Like,
yeah.
I was going I spent a day at the British Library a few months ago going back through all the papers from back then, and like there were so many references to the Second World War.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. There was one game after this where Spurs won, like the headline was Hair Raid Warning. There was I think a report in The Sun about this particular game made reference to the fact that Sink the Bismarck was on Channel 4 that same day. Like, it's so, like, the obsession with the Second World War is everywhere, and that people just cannot forgive Klinsmann for simply being German. At one point, I found a headline in the Daily Express which referred to Spurs Ethnic Army.
Blimey.
And the language referring to the Romanians, or
the language, like the casual xenophobia.
Bloody
and the language used about people who are not English, and so much like foreign invasion is there everywhere. Like, is really remarkable. Like, it does. It's I guess it's the flip side of how exotic this was. Like, this had never happened before. People were really surprised about it. They didn't really know how to take it on board, and it produced mountains of awful xenophobia and racism.
But wasn't there that line from Alan, or a line Alan Sugar said had been used of him, that the Romanians are used to having a mad dictator in control, so they'll be fine with him.
Yeah, so that's a line in Alan Sugar's autobiography. He says that somebody wrote that. He says that that is in one of the tabloids where he signed Popescu and Dumitrescu. I went back through all the tabloids and I couldn't find any such sentence.
Okay.
But that's not to say it wasn't said.
But you're right, it is very dispiriting because as a football fan and as a teenager, when I was seeing all that happen, you just think, oh, wow, this is incredible. And you have those memories. But when you start to kind of really go through it all, you think, blimey, it was. You would think that people would be welcoming with open arms a World Cup winner who, as you say, is one of a number of key players who helped develop the English game. Really, you can't underestimate that too much, and yet he's getting a barrage of a load of nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, look, it doesn't condone it in any way. I think Klinsmann is a particular case because his diving had so offended people in the World Cup in 1990, particularly. I think in the Euros in 1988. So there is a sort of slightly more legitimate aspect of a criticism of Klinsmann.
Yeah,
but then the language it's couched in, it's entirely legitimate for people to go, I'm a bit concerned about the way he's dived.
Oh, I get that.
What's going to happen if he does that?
If he's a diver, I understand. He was a diver. There's no two ways about that. And that was a shame that is part of how you remember Klinsmann being a phenomenal player. But all the stuff that you're saying here, Jack, was written in the newspaper.
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, I think the diving stuff did go a bit overboard. Like, he was described in The Sun as one of the most notorious cheats in European football. and sometimes the diving...
That's classic tabloid sanctimony. It is overboard, but it is what the tabloids do. So.
Sometimes the diving stuff and the German stuff would come together, and he was described as a Stuttgart dive bomber.
Oh, right, yeah.
At points.
Well, let's go back to Tottenham and Ardiles themselves. So they won this game 4-3.
A little mention
of David Hurst scoring a beautiful volley.
Brilliant volley from David Hurst. And then Klinsmann goes off and being knocked unconscious.
He kind of
goes up for a header with Des Walker.
Yeah.
I think he got knocked out and had to be carried off.
So proper British steel.
I was going to say, what an introduction to the game. He certainly didn't dive there. We can all agree. So Spurs win the game 4-3, and they have a very good start to the season. They won, 3 out of 4, something like that. You know, they're going very well. They're scoring a lot of goals.
And Klinsmann, so 4 days after that, Klinsmann's first game at White Hart Lane, he scores a overhead kick.
Beauty.
Which is the first, it's obviously the first time he's played in front of the home crowd. Would have been the first time that most of the people in that stadium have ever seen him in the flesh. And he scores this kind of the goal that only someone who's won the World Cup and the UEFA Cup and you've spent £2 million on would score. And that was a real moment of like, wow, this guy's for real. And also, it was soon after that that people started talking about whether Spurs could win the title. They beat Ipswich Town 3-1 with a brilliant performance, which seemed like all the kind of the combination of the Ardiles approach and the individual quality of the signings came together. And after that game, I think 3 or 4 games into the season, people genuinely talked about Spurs as title contenders.
Mm. I mean, it shows you the level that they were playing at in those first sort of handful of games.
It shows a difference to the modern world that in those days you could sign 3 players and that could turn you from being essentially a mid-table team into title challengers because the elite teams weren't as elite.
Yeah, and it's funny, reading your piece about this team, Jack, I just maybe hadn't been aware. I knew that they used to bomb forward and attack, but Ardiles was almost a sort of slightly he was a bit of a figure of fun and a bit of a jokey figure. And yet when you look back at it, you know, there was a moment there when actually Spurs looked like that they could maybe win the title, or they were doing something, because it didn't last very long.
Yeah, so it didn't take long for them to start losing games, not just losing games, but losing games really badly. Mm. They would concede huge amounts of goals. Teams realised that they were so attacking. Everybody would attack except for 3 players, three outfield players. They were very, very easy to score against. They wouldn't press properly. Dumitrescu didn't do any defending whatsoever. There was one point where Klinsmann, I think they lost 3-1 to Leicester, I think at home, and Klinsmann like hammered his teammates in an interview afterwards, said, "We're not aggressive enough. If we're going to play this way, we've got to press and defend from the front," which they did. They just didn't do. And Ardiles had that classic thing of a very attacking manager, which is, if it's not working, we've just got to do plan A better. There wasn't a plan B.
Yeah.
And you can see this with...
But it's an interesting thing that he even got the job, because he obviously done very well at Swindon when I think he was technically still a player manager, and he actually played a couple of games over 2 seasons. And of course, they should have been promoted in 1990 when they beat Sunderland in the playoff final and then end up not going up because of the illegal payments, which it happened on Lee McCarvey's watch. It wasn't anything to do with Ardiles. And he had a good reputation. That Swindon team played good football and they were an attractive side to watch and they seemed relatively well balanced. But then let's not forget he lost his job at Newcastle and was replaced by the more conservative Kevin Keegan. It was an act of retrenchment for Newcastle to appoint Kevin Keegan.
We need to tighten up.
Yeah. And then it was, I guess he'd done okay at West Brom, but I don't think he'd sort of done anything extraordinary at West Brom. So it was a big job for him to get. And it's obviously it's the Solskjaer or Lampard principle of bringing the crowd favour from the past. But he's quite an unusual crowd favour to bring in that... You mentioned being a figure of fun. One of the reasons for that is Ozzy's going to Wembley and everybody sort of laughs at his accent in Tottenham.
Yeah.
Which, again, to modern ears, it's a little bit uncomfortable.
It is, yeah.
And I guess he went along with it and was fine with it. But it's not... I suppose, to be fair to him, you talk to David Pleat, he talks about how valuable late-period Ardiles was in sitting in front of the back four when he's playing as a much deeper lying player and his intelligence of sort of reading the game. So he obviously did have that. But there was this sort of... Yeah, he was in the classic school of British perceptions of foreign people. Yeah, yeah. He's an Officer Crabtree. He's an Inspector Clouseau figure. Yeah, look at him being slightly different to us and speaking English in a funny way. Mm. Actually, obviously, Crabtree is English, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, was it 10 games he had?
No, so he was... Basically, they lost 5-2 at Main Road.
Yeah.
Which was actually my first ever Manchester City game, so an important day in my life. And then they lost 3-0 at Notts County in the Coca-Cola Cup. And then he was sacked, so he had 12 league games that season.
Okay.
1-5,
lost 5, scored 21, conceded 24. So it was quite a...
mixed bag.
Yeah.
The fans had turned on that Notts County game, didn't they?
I think they were singing for him to be sacked.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of remember that from that Newcastle-Charlton game. The fans had turned, you sort of think a kind of, you know, a sort of charismatic, sort of cuddly figure like that, fans don't turn on, but yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Well, it's the results that matter.
Yeah, but I don't know, I still think...
Do you feel it was too soon?
Maybe.
Because the piece you wrote, there's an element of, it's just a shame that it didn't... Well, obviously it's a shame it didn't work out, but also might he have been able to turn it around?
Yeah, I think it was quite hasty. I think Sugar buckled as soon as the fans turned, and Sugar could have given him another 10 games. He could have given him the rest of the season.
He could have done, but on the other hand, if you've invested, £7 million quid, near enough, on
a lot of money
players,
back then.
And you're thinking, shit, we got Jürgen Klinsmann. We can't waste this. And you could imagine sort of Klinsmann, however professional he may be in training or whatever, you can imagine a big star like that thinking, this guy's a bit of a joke. Right. I've got to move to a club where they actually can defend.
But the other way of looking at it is, if you spend £8 million on three exciting players, you should pursue having a manager who can get the best, who can play a style of play that they might want to play, rather than just going back to Jerry Francis.
But, I mean, yeah, okay, that's also true.
Mm.
But, you know, when Jerry Francis is an option, can you afford to let it slip back?
Well, they finished seventh in the league, Spurs. They would end up finishing seventh, and then semi-finals of the FA Cup. And Klinsmann didn't hang around for very long, of course, much to the annoyance of Alan Sugar.
Yeah, so I think Klinsmann had a clause in his contract which said that he could go after a season, I think, if a certain fee was met or if a certain type of club came in. And Sugar, even though this clause was in his contract, Sugar thought it was incredibly ungentlemanly for Klinsmann to actually exercise this clause. And this prompted the kind of rant about Carlos Kickable.
Mm.
And Sugar went public and criticised Klinsmann. Basically, after Klinsmann had said, oh yeah, I am going to Bayern Munich, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But he got, Klinsmann won. Like, he got his way and he went to Bayern.
Yeah. But you talk about the importance of this side, how they were playing this kind of attacking style of play, which we now see a little bit more. It's more common in the Premier League, perhaps.
Yeah.
Would you dare to use the word pioneering?
Yeah, I would. I do think they were pioneers. I think, like, as Jonathan said earlier, the biggest thread, I think, in the history of the Premier League is cosmopolitanism.
Mm-hmm.
It's changing from a league which was English to a league which was international but played in England. And that refers to players, owners, tactics, everything. And this was the first time, really, we saw foreign players, foreign tactics, tried in English football. And of course it didn't work. And probably it was never going to work. But if they hadn't tried it, then who knows whether or not Chelsea would have tried it, Arsenal would have tried it. And of course, it was only 2 years after this that Wenger came in. And, you know, foreign tactics, foreign players, it was incredibly successful. But I think the difference is that Wenger had a really, really good foundation to build on. Like, as everybody always says, he had this kind of English back five. And that meant that it was slightly easier for him to integrate the foreign players and the more attacking football, whereas Spurs didn't really have the quality of defence. And that meant there was no foundation to all the attacking that they were doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Jack, it's been a pleasure talking to you about that game and about that Aussie Ardiles Spurs team. Because again, it can slip the memory, this stuff. So excellent stuff. Thank you very much for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard, everybody. Thank you, Jonathan. A pleasure as always. Jack, always great to see you. For more stories like this, go to theblizzard.co.uk. We shall be back next week. See you then.
Mark Williams again, in for Taylor. That's a good header. Well, that's a great volley by David Hurst. Terrific volley. And that could put Wednesday back in the game at 4-3. Nice support header. Terrific volley by Hurst.
This was a Stakhanov production. Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.